I'm Adam Lesser, and this is Notes on Your Notes. Josh is off this week. He's basically recovering from producing an amazing show at the Marsh Theater up in San Francisco for us. If you missed it was awesome. Email us, we'll come to your city. It's a great experience. As some of you know, I was in New Orleans recently, and it's a pretty amazing city, and one of the more amazing things about it are the writers who live there. And I was really lucky I got a chance to sit down with M.L. Walsh. If you don't know his name, you should. He had a book in 2015 called My Sunshine Away that wound up on the New York Times bestseller list, got translated into 11 languages. And he runs the graduate writing workshop at the University of New Orleans. And I took the bus up there one day, and he was kind enough to sit down with me. The University of New Orleans is just steps from the beautiful expanse of Lake Pontchartrain. And we talked about MO's creative process. He was really open. He talked about the long journey and how it took him 7 years to write My Sunshine Away. Walsh got early praise for a short story collection, and he sort of thought he had it made. And then it wound up taking him 7 years to write his first novel, which was well received. And he really gets into what happened.
I remember one time in graduate school, it was right after I'd finished. So my collection was kind of done, and I was celebrating at a bar, and I saw a professor there. And he was like, "Well, how are things going since you finished?" I was like, "Oh, man, it's amazing. Like, I've written like 40 pages on this new novel, like in the last 2 weeks. I'm so psyched. Like, everything's going great." He said, "40 pages, huh?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Talk to me when you get to 50. And I mean, sure enough, like I hit page 50 and I was like, "Oh, like there's nothing here."
Walsh's novel, My Sunshine Away, is the story of an unsolved rape of a 15-year-old girl in a Baton Rouge neighborhood, otherwise quiet neighborhood. And it's told as a recollection later on from a man in his early 30s who was around and friends with the girl at the time. And it's interesting because there's a universality and both a complexity to that time, that early adolescence of being 15, 16 years old, that I thought it captured extraordinarily well. You can tell from the reading that Walsh took a lot of time with the language he used, and he really gets into how he got through writing to the end, and long-form projects can be so difficult. Walsh and I spent almost 2 hours together, and we covered everything from his creative process to his journey writing My Sunshine Away to, in the end, his favorite places to eat in New Orleans. Enjoy the interview. M.O. Walsh, welcome to Notes on Your Notes. I like to start interviews with a question that I think our listeners care about. It's a show about the creative process and storytelling, and it's just to ask you, what is your writing process? I believe I read in an interview that you write from 4 to 6 a.m. each day. And so the first question is, can you confirm or deny whether that's true?
That was true. Right when my daughter was born. I have two kids now. And so that was the type of thing where it was the only time I could steal any time away. I had to sort of be at work by 8 o'clock to teach. And then between 6 and 8, I was dealing, feeding baby food and all that type of stuff. And so, when I was in college and grad school, I was always able to write kind of late at night, feeling inspired after the bars and stuff, and quickly realized that wasn't going to work at all anymore. My life was just too hectic. And so, like you always kind of do, you just kind of got to find time, and so that became my time. I'd get up at 4, I'd write till 6, feed the kid, go to work. It helped. It was the only thing I could do to get it done, I don't have that same schedule now. I kind of wish I did, because I think that early morning writing time is the best time. But I just sort of steal time now, whenever I can. I try to block out at least one day a week that I don't look at my email, I don't do all that type of stuff, and just work. And then other than that, I grabbed an hour before this interview, just sort of grabbed time. But in terms of my process, I guess it's changed over the years. I think that when I first started, I was like most people I know, just so excited to sort of get ideas out, and I would just sit around and just come up with anything and not worry that much about it. And now I've become one of these people that's like I get much more pleasure out of like the rewriting and revision process than I do out of any sort of first drafting. First drafting to me just feels, I don't know, like pulling teeth these days. I don't know why. The blank page is just hard for me. But if I get like a I know it sounds like I'm overstating this, but if I get it like a new paragraph one day, that's great because I know that's like my next week's work, you know, because I can go back and revise and sort of add and stuff like that. So I've just gotten into this space where it's just it's not that the writing part isn't fun. It's just where I find the fun has changed. You know, I find the fun much more in sort of honing things, sentence level, paragraph level stuff than I do sort of the big story. Like I used to.
That's fascinating to me because I think a lot of people earlier in their writing career are exactly what you say, the opposite. There's almost like this euphoric pleasure from just riding that wave. Maybe they come home from a bar or even if they're up early writing, and then things can change for some people where they get actually more interested in sentence level work in the process, in the development. Was there a moment for you where that began to change, where that became more interesting to you?
Well, I would say probably switching from stories to novels, you know, and where I just think that once I was sort of in the middle of, you know, 100 pages or so, that was very different than, okay, well, I'm just going to write this 7-page story and let's just sort of let it fly. You know, a novel has there's so many responsibilities, you know, and it's the type of thing where, you know, I get it why some people don't want to write them, and I get it why other people get addicted to them. You know, it feels to me, I'm realizing now, it's like all the stuff I've always liked about writing, but sort of like on crack. You know, it's just even more intense. You know, and so I think that what happened to me is when I got in the novel, I wrote like the first chapter really sort of quickly. It's like, okay, here's my story. And then as I was writing, I realized, well, I can't just bang out this whole plot. Like, I don't have it figured out yet. I don't have all that. And so what I started to do is just sort of slow down and say, okay, well, let's make what I have the best it can be and then move forward, you know? And so that also became a problem, like everything does, because I would sit down to work on the novel and start at page one every time for like a period of years, basically. And so it would get to be where I'd have to read like 70 pages before I would get to where I'd stopped, and I'd write like one new sentence. I'm like, okay, well, the day's done because I've been here for 4 hours, but I've only moved one sentence ahead. But at the same time, I don't really regret it. And I told myself I was going to do something different with this book I'm working on now, but I'm finding myself falling back into that habit, which is, you know, I say I don't regret it because by the time I got done with my first novel, I mean, it was pretty much done. It wasn't the type of thing where I had to go back and do really wholesale changes, because I'd been, like I said, I'd just been combing it the whole time. And so with this one, I'm like, well, I'm just gonna let it fly. I'm just gonna write chapters out of order. I'm gonna do all that stuff. And here I find myself like a year later, basically like yesterday, I sat down and I read like the first 120 pages, like in one sitting, you know, just making sure everything felt right. And that's the pleasure. I feel like I've become more of like a fixer of things than a sort of like creator. You know, it's like if I get one paragraph down, I'm happy to go back that next day and fix it. More so than I feel excited about writing that next scene that I don't exactly know what it's going to be. That's where the panic sets in.
So do you actually enjoy that process of fixing each paragraph the next day?
Yeah, that's like the only thing.
It's so interesting because the screenwriter Eric Roth, he wrote Forrest Gump and a bunch of other, he actually, every day he starts by reading from page one what he's written. Like, so he could be on page 70 of the script. He begins his day each day by reading the first page. And it's so interesting to me. It's almost like for some writers, they need to keep that story from this page one, that narrative in their head. And so I wonder about that, because one of the things as you're talking, I was like, do you outline? Like, when you start to think of a story, is it a note-taking process that turns into an outline? How does that process work for you?
Yeah, well, the first thing I would say about why I like to go back and read stuff before I start on a fresh, unwritten sentence is you got to get that voice back in your head, you know? And so, especially with my first novel, it was first person, you know, and it was very much, there was a certain rhythm to the voice and a certain, you know, at least in my mind, a certain cadence that the person spoke in. And so I like to get back in that. And so once you do that, I feel like the sentences come to you in that way again, right? So that's part of why I think it's important to start back. But like I was saying, it's, you know, when you get to where you're 100 pages in a novel, your workday is not long enough to do that, you know? So I had to sort of adapt, and I'd go back and maybe read like two chapters and then start. And that's kind of what I'm doing again now. But as far as outlining, I didn't really do that on the first on my first novel. What I would do is I had like a stack of index cards, and anytime I had an idea, because as you know, as everybody knows, like most of your writing happens away from the computer, right? I mean, you're sitting in traffic and you have an idea and all that type of stuff, but you can't actually type. And so I would just always have those on me, and I'd write down something. If I had a certain line that I wanted to happen later in the novel, and it came to me, I'd write it on the index card and just put it back in my pocket. Or if I had a certain scene idea, I'd write scene and then, you know, put one little sentence, put it back in my pocket. And then whenever I would sit down to write, I'd take out the index cards and sort of look and see, okay, well, what are these scenes, and sort of, you know, rearrange them. Which one of these scenes have I written? Whenever I write it, I'd put a check on it, put it in the back. You know, so it wasn't really outlining. I didn't really know. I think I knew mentally sort of like where I wanted the novel to go, but I'd never had like a sort of really nice orderly chart. You know, I just had this sort of stack of cards that I would rearrange and look at, and it helped me track my progress in some ways, and help me make use of those times, like I said, when you can't write but you have a good idea. I would just jot it down. I sat down and I tried to outline this novel I'm working on now, and it's I haven't looked at it since I did that. So I don't know how helpful that is for me. I know some people, that's what they live off of. And I wish I did. You know, I mean, there's so many, you hear about so many writers' process, and you feel jealous. You know, it's like, wow, that sounds so much easier than what I do, or that sounds so much more effective or efficient. You know, but we're all who we are. You know, I mean, you figure out, you write long enough, you kind of figure out how you work the best. And so mine is not really all that orderly. It's more just thinking about it for months before I sit down and write it, you know. And so I've started with the index cards again on this one. You know, hopefully that'll help me out. We'll see.
I think some also writers find it helpful to think of that outline as a revisable document, because I think what sometimes is tricky is that people write that outline and they get really tied to that outline. And as everyone knows, as they start to work on long form work, as you go beyond short stories or even short movies, short films, that is a changing document now, because you characters surprise you and things take new turns. And these are projects that can take years. I mean, I was interested, My Sunshine Away took you 7 years, right? And I imagine over that time, that narrative started to slowly reveal itself to you, right?
Yeah, the plot reveals itself to you. Like you said, things surprise you. There are things that writers are often like just too dumb to see for themselves, you know, like in the moment, you know, and then later, you know, you had some time to sit back on it and you look and you're like, oh, well, there it is. You know, it's been here the whole time. I just didn't see it. But not only that, but you're changing too, you know, as a person. And so it's like, you know, I had kids while I was writing this book, and that's definitely changed me as a writer. You know, I think that I could have written the same sort of plot that My Sunshine Away has before I had kids, but I don't think it would be the same book at all. You know, I mean, it gave it a certain direction that it didn't have before. It just gave it a focus it didn't have. And also, I don't know, it's just like expanded my empathy, you know, in the world, you know. So I don't see characters as sort of superficially as I did before, even when I'm reading. You know, I mean, I'll read student stories that are great, and they just really hurt my feelings, you know, because something's happening involving maybe a child or a parent and that I never would have seen before. And I can see my students thinking, well, this is interesting and shocking because of this situation with a kid. And I'm thinking, no, this is awful for the parent, you know, and like there's just certain things that you don't really, that I didn't see before. You know, I guess I wish I was a more expansive reader earlier. But in the process, I changed. You know, so I think that's part of what takes novelists a long time, is, you know, trying to write the same book as you're sort of a moving target too. You know, things are happening in your life that change the way you view the world, right? So, and that's one of the reasons I think a lot of novels are so hard to finish, because the writer's different than when they started them. So unless you, and this is, you know, a lot of it's to do with luck. Like, unless you sort of latch on to a story that you sort of fundamentally feel the same about as you're also aging and changing, then yeah, it's really hard to finish. But I think most of the good novels you read is because that writer feels something very true about that story.
I believe you had two children during the writing of My Sunshine Away, and I'm curious how it obviously probably flipped things upside down in terms of sleep schedules and your time. Some writers have said that having children actually can focus them, that it actually, they don't screw around anymore. Others just say it's an incredible sort of pressure, because having a normal schedule when you have children can be very complicated. Where do you sort of fall in that?
Well, I think both things are totally true. The schedule thing is absolutely true in that it changes everything, like the free time and, you know, people, you know, that's what I tell, you know, I teach an MFA program and I understand that our graduate students are very busy and their lives are very hectic, but I tell them all the time, you're never going to have this much time to write again, ever, you know, and like, I know you don't think that's true, but it's very, very true. Like, take advantage of it, you know, produce pages right now. Because yeah, life happens and things, you know, you can set out a whole day. I'm going to write all day Wednesday. It's going to be my blessed writing day. And then your kid wakes up coughing and he doesn't go to school. And so you're stuck at home. You know what I'm saying? Those things, it's not like those things are anomalies. They happen all the time. Right. And so, yeah, you've got to be willing to adapt and grab the time whenever. So I agree that it makes it harder in that sense. But like I was saying before, at least, you know, this is not a prescription for everybody. I'm not saying everyone go have kids so this will happen to you. But what happened for me is I think I definitely became a better writer almost just immediately. Just like I was saying, just because of the sort of the way my sort of empathy machine expanded, you know? I mean, I wasn't, although I still like to have fun and, you know, all that type of stuff, I wasn't as flippant with what was happening to the characters as I would have been before, you know? And so I think that's part of it. And then, you know, of course, the other part of it is you've got people like depending on you. And that's a different thing. Like, you know, I would say I was probably more joyful when no one depended on my writing doing anything. Right. Because that's a great, great moment. It's like just your little secret. It doesn't really matter what happens with it. And then, you know, it's like I think almost all writers would want to be if you do write something that people read, well, suddenly you're like, wait a second, someone's going to read the next thing I write. Shit, you know, it's like that's a different sort of feeling than I think a lot of people are used to, you know. And that's the same thing with kids. It's like, okay, well, if I want to make a career on this writing thing, well, and you look down, you got two little kids, like, can I have some milk? And you're like, well, the milk depends on me making up an interesting story or an interesting character. That's not cool. Because I don't know, a lot of writers have this great faith in their ability. I don't have that at all. Like, I feel like, you know, I work really hard. I do the best that I can. I feel like I got very lucky, you know, with this novel. You know, like we were discussing earlier, there's so many great writers that just never get a break, and it has nothing to do with their talent, nothing to do with their skill. It's just a strange mix of things that sort of needs to happen, you know, for them. And so I don't necessarily sit around thinking, yes, you know, the next thing I write is going to do just as well. I don't have that feeling at all. I feel like I got really lucky. I'm going to just do my best and see what happens. But that's a nervous making thing, I think.
Does your process for you feel like a discipline, like meaning the hours you try to keep as a writer? Does it feel like an effortful discipline and it's fulfilling, or is it more something that you just feel like you look forward to and you're happy to have that time? Like, is it different at different times?
Yeah. I think it's different at different times. I think that I very much enjoy like the challenge of it. And like most, I think like most writers I know, I'm sort of, you know, self-loathing and sadistic in some ways. You know, it's like I very much like not being pleased with what I've done. I don't know why. But I like that challenge of trying again and again and realizing it's not the best it can be, but I'm going to try to make it better over and over and over again. And writing's the hardest thing I've ever tried to do, you know, except for maybe like trigonometry or something. I'm not good at math. But, you know, the only thing I've ever in reading something that I've written that after like a couple of years doesn't look like garbage to me is one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done. Right. So it's yeah, I mean, it's just I know that no one's going to be more disappointed in what I've written than me than in the first couple of drafts. So that sort of like feeds that, I guess, you know, inner competitive spirit with myself or something. But then I also know that if I do it right and I feel good about it, that's basically the most the most pleasurable thing I've done, from, you know, is create something that I don't hate, which is not easy, you know.
There's definitely a distinct pleasure, that feeling like you earned it and it took time and you sculpted it. And that's rare, because I imagine, not all the time, but I imagine you also encounter students who really like their first drafts, who feel like their words are really great.
Well, and lots of times they are, right? But I think there's that big difference between that sort of first sort of burst of an idea, right, and then like what art is, you know? I mean, it's everyone has ideas, you know, and like not everyone can create art, you know? And I think that's where the sort of discipline comes in. That's, you know, for me, I like, and I know, again, I know everyone's different. Some people, I guess, are just sort of born with this skill, but it was, writing was something I definitely learned, you know? I mean, it was, I'd always liked to read and I'd always liked to write, but I was no good at it at all. I mean, even through college and my first stint in grad school, it wasn't until I went to get an MFA that I had people that were just sort of willing to sort of like totally break me down and say, look, this is just not good, and I'll show you why, right? And so understanding that and the sort of, I think that's the, when I think of discipline, I think of when I sit down to write, I've got, you know, like five, you know, voices in my head from past teachers or from writers I really admire that are constantly sort of saying, you know, is this the best you can do? You know, like, are you just trying to bullshit me again? You know, and that, I like that. I like having to sort of go through that gauntlet, you know, like, okay, you know, one of my professors at Ole Miss was Barry Hanna, who's a Southern story writer. I love his stuff. And he's in my head all day. I mean, he's been dead for years, but he's always in my head. And I like going up against that. We don't always agree, obviously. And sometimes I'm sure I'd write stuff that he would still think is no good. But I like the idea that I've sort of got those sort of voices, you know, and I think that when we talk about teaching, you know, teaching creative writing, I think that's all it is. Like a good teacher of creative writing is just someone who has a sort of consistent, strong voice that will sort of implant itself in the writer's head from here on out, right? And so whether or not the MFA student or just the young writer agrees with that teacher or not, they're there, right, in their head, and they understand, okay, well, this is this person's aesthetic, and when I write something, what would they think of it, right? Would they hate it? If so, and I still want to do it, well, here are my reasons. Right? Things like that. So that's what makes the most sense to me, is you just want to be sort of strong and consistent and have a sort of a take on writing that this person will remember.
Hearing you talk, it's almost like you're the ideal person to teach creative writing, because for you, it sounds like there was this distinct period where you didn't know if you could do it, and you went through the process of learning to write, and then ultimately went on to Ole Miss to do your MFA, which is a very well-known, famous MFA program. And like, I think that sometimes people who end up writing in MFA programs are people who've been very gifted from a young age for whatever reason. Maybe they were training earlier, maybe they knew younger. But I think part of it does require the belief that this can be taught. And so I wanted to ask you about that. As someone who runs a graduate creative writing program and teaches students all the time, how possible do you think it is to turn people into really good writers? And what have you learned as a writer from being a teacher?
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely think it can be taught, just like reading can be taught, right? But what can't be taught is vision. You know, I mean, you can make, and I guess this is what people think, you know, the argument that MFA programs are just making all these sort of capable writers, but no one really great or whatever. I sort of have a problem with that too, but I understand that argument, because really all we can do is teach sort of like effective communication. We're really no different than people that are teaching rhetoric. You know, I mean, we're teaching, how do you build something to make someone feel the way you want them to feel? You know, I mean, that's it. And that usually starts with clear sentences. It usually starts, you know, characterization, all that type of stuff. That can all be taught. That said, just like anything else in life, I mean, some people in the room are more interesting than others. You know, some people walk into a room and they notice different things than others. You really can't teach that. You know, you can't, you know, it's not, I don't think it's very useful to just be like, okay, this is a good story, but you just as a person need to be more interesting, you know? but sometimes that's just the case, right? And so, you know, I think that to back up a minute, I don't think that it's true that workshops just sort of bring everyone to the middle and make everyone the sort of same based on the teacher's, you know, aesthetic, or that it's, that it just totally normalizes everything. I don't think that's true. I think it does that to the weakest writers. Okay. So, the people who were going to be good writers to begin with, they have to have that sort of stubborn, adherence to their own vision, right? I mean, you have to have that. But what you're learning is that, like I said earlier, the sort of discipline and what good, clear communication is, right? If you have 10 people in the room, tell you that, well, I just don't understand this, and you're going to be so stubborn that you don't change it and no one gets it. Well, that's one problem. But if you have, you know, three people in the room that just say, well, I don't really understand what the story's about, and you totally change it to appease so that you can appease everyone, well, then you have a problem. You know, so I think that although it's true that all we can really teach is that sort of the sort of mode of communication, I do think that those writers that have that vision, that have always been sort of interesting observers of the world, right? They come out of these programs, I think, writing really well. And they're going to go on in their life and make their own decisions. It's not like you're in school forever, you know? And so as soon as they graduate, hopefully they have the voices in their head of people that they agreed with and admire and respect, and then they make their own decisions.
Sometimes I hear this expressed as you need to go, like when we talk about people who have vision or don't have vision, like you need to go out and live a little, meaning the stories you write when you're 23 are not the stories you write when you're 40, and that your perspective and point of view when you're 40 could actually be much more interesting because you spent time and you've had relationships and children and you've lived a little. Do you think that's true? Do you think that, like, because sometimes you encounter really gifted writers who don't necessarily have a point of view that is compelling or interesting or really interesting. They're not like the most interesting person at the party. Do you think that change, do you observe that changing sometimes over time?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I could make a sort of blank statement about that, because some people, in their early 20s have very old souls. They've gone through a lot, you know, and they don't really necessarily need to go to Istanbul to understand that life is complicated or something, you know. Whereas you do have other people that have just been in high school, just gone to college, just right into graduate school, and they really haven't done much else. And these are often the students that are writing stories about their dorm room, you know, and which are just hard. College stories are like really hard. I mean, I talk about that all the time to my students. Like, find me three great college literary short stories. Just try to find me them, you know. And we can find like Drinking Coffee Elsewhere by ZZ Packer is pretty good. We can find, you know, maybe one or two others, but like, why don't these stories exist? Well, it's because, at least it seems to me, nothing's at stake in those stories. Like, you're in this weird sort of liminal space in college. What does it matter if you get high? What does it matter if you sleep with three people in one night? None of it matters, because you're out in a couple of years, right? And then real life starts. And whereas you just move I know this is not the question you asked, but like, you just move the sort of age earlier in high school, and you see people making mistakes, and we're like, oh man, well, this mistake could change their whole life, you know, or they're older and they've got a family. Oh, this mistake could change. There's stakes all of a sudden, right? And so, yeah, when I think we have older, older students writing, they typically do have more of that sort of, not just literal scenes and stuff, and not just literal sort of material, but they have a lot more emotional material. You know, they've just been through more stuff. I remember when I was in school, when I was in grad school, one of our professors was putting together an anthology called like 40 over 40 or something. And it was like 40 short stories by writers over the age of 40, because my professor was under the impression that no one under the age of 40 wrote anything worth a damn. And this incensed me, because I was like 25, right? So I was furious about it. I realize now why he's doing this, why he did it, right? Because there is a certain maturity level that comes with older writers, I think. But those young voices are just as important. You know, I mean, I'm not that old, I'm 41. When I read some of our, 23-year-old MFA students' work, I understand that they came up in a different world than I did. And I want those stories. I need those. You know, I mean, the way that these narrators view the world is not mine. Right. And so I would hate to say, no, you got to be older. I just don't think it's true. I think that there's good stories for every age range.
You're listening to Notes on Your Notes, a podcast about the creative process and storytelling. I'm Adam Lesser. When we get back, Emo will dig through his breakthrough novel, My Sunshine Way. He talks about what it means to be a Southern writer, how fatherhood changed him as a writer, and he even tells us his favorite places to eat in New Orleans. If you're enjoying this interview, please go to the iTunes store and rate us. We're growing as a podcast, and it just helps move things along. You can also find information about all our future episodes from our Facebook page, which you can check out, Notes on Your Notes. Back to the show. Baton Rouge is where My Sunshine Away takes place. It's where you grew up. Let me just start with an overall question, which is, how do you remember your childhood? My Sunshine Away is such an interesting book because it's essentially a book of remembrance. The narrator is much older and he's remembering this period in his life from his early adolescence. So maybe start with what was your childhood like in Baton Rouge?
Yeah, well, very similar to the narrator's. I mean, I grew up in a sort of little suburban, you know, nice little area in Baton Rouge. Went to a nice high school. You know, the geography and everything in the novel is very, very similar to what my own was. And to me, I'm one of these people that I just felt like I had this great childhood. You know, I think a lot of people do. You know, we played football out in the street until the streetlights came on. We were able to wander wherever we went. We rode our bikes everywhere. I never felt afraid, you know, growing up, and I'm very lucky in that way. I recognize that. But it was the type of thing where, you know, the older I got, and the more sort of I learned about what was actually happening around me when I was young. You know, you learn about what happened in your parents' relationship if they got divorced. You know, you learn about what was going on with the neighbors down the street. You know, you learn that, you know, the kid that you just thought was weird actually had this incredibly sad story. You know, you start learning all these things. And so I've always just been really interested in the way that we have to sort of like shape and reshape our own memories to sort of stay sane, you know, like, and lots of times I sort of like willingly hold on to the great nostalgic view of my childhood, rather than digging into some of the things I realize now are actually happening. Right. And so, you know, I would say my childhood was great, you know, for me as a kid inside of it, you know, looking, if I was going to step back and look and just sort of quantify, like on a spreadsheet, what actually happened, well, it might be one that's seen as like full of tragedy or something, but mine was, I never felt it like that, you know. I really enjoyed it. And so Baton Rouge was important for me to write about. I lived there for like the first 21 years of my life, you know, before I moved away. And it was the type of thing where I would move away and tell someone about Baton Rouge, and they, of course, had no idea what that really meant. It's such a sort of generic place, you know, for everyone else. But to me, I was always like, no, it's great. Like, you got to come visit. We got to hang out. I'll take you here. I'll take you here. We'll do all this type of stuff. I love it. And that feeling never changed for me. And so, you know, I'd written short stories, had a book of stories and all that type of stuff, and was sitting down. I'd tried a couple novels that did not work out at all. And then whenever the sort of idea for this one presented itself to me, and I was like, well, this is Baton Rouge. You know, this is finally, I'm going to actually write about the place I know the most about. And that was a huge help. And that would be, if we're giving advice, that would be advice I would give just about any writer, like, find help wherever you can in your own creations. You know, I mean, people, I'm not saying don't be ambitious, but you can be ambitious with the subject matter, theme, and all that type of stuff. But in a novel, if you can help yourself out in any way in terms of like just setting, in terms of just knowing your boundaries and giving yourself boundaries, you know, as an example, you know, just trying to close in some of the spaces of a novel, like make it one neighborhood, and, you know, don't have it sprawling everywhere. Make it things you can see, you know, use houses you've been in, you know, just things like that I think a lot of writers don't do because they feel like they're not interesting, and, you know, and they want to really just, everything has to be brand new and has to be different than their own experience. I think if you're embarking on like a years long, you know, process, just help yourself out, however you can.
Yeah, it was interesting when I read interviews with you about how you had tried to write two other novels when you were working on My Sunshine Away. How did you know that finally this was the one you needed to write to the end? And I'm curious how you view the time you spent working on those other two books. Like, do you view that now as wasted time, or do you view that as sort of, this was just part of you finding your subject matter?
Yeah, no, I don't view it as wasted now, although there was a time in my life when I did, when I was so desperate, you know, to get a book out. I definitely was grumpy. I mean, part of it is just that there's just, and I've said this before, but there's just such a difference between an idea and a story, right? And so what I had novels that had an idea, right? And it was like, well, wouldn't this be a cool novel if, you know, and one of them is about aliens and all this type of stuff. Anyway, I'm not going to get into it. But wouldn't that be cool? And yes, I think it's still a cool concept. I like it. But there was no story there. There was nothing sort of fundamental driving the characters. You know, it was just an idea. And so that got me about, you know, 80 pages. And then I realized, well, I have nothing really to say. You know, all the cool bells and whistles I was interested in, I've already done. And so it would be the type of thing where I'd just go back to it and I'm just not that interested in it anymore, you know, and just sort of fell apart. With this one, I just never lost interest. I think that's the main thing. You know, I would go, you know, I remember one time in graduate school, it was right after I'd finished. So my collection was kind of done and I was celebrating at a bar and I saw a professor there and he was like, well, how are things going since you finished? I was like, oh man, it's amazing. Like I've written like 40 pages on this new novel, like in the last 2 weeks, I'm so psyched. Like everything's going great. He said, 40 pages, huh? I said, yeah. He said, talk to me when you get to 50. And I mean, sure enough, like I hit page 50 and I was like, oh, like there's nothing here. There's nothing here. I was just, because that first 50 pages of a novel is just, you're just setting things up, you know, and that's fun. You're setting things up because you don't have to deal with anything yet. Then suddenly you turn that corner and you're like, oh, like I've put all these things in play. Now I got to deal with them. And lots of times you realize, well, I don't really want to, you know, like I'm not that interested in dealing with it. I was interested just in that early sort of, that early complication, you know, and that's why that sort of act two is just brutal. You know, that's what I'm going to right now in the novel I'm working on. And it's just, I'm like, I know where I want to end up, but getting there, man, it's going to be hard, you know?
You know, there's a reason they call it act two blues. Yeah. Everyone who's written screenplays has gone through this. Writing that first act is so much fun. You get to set it up. Everything's exciting. And then you've got 60 pages or an hour of film time where you have to show the character's journey, the conflict, what they're up against, how they're going to develop. And that's when it gets brutal.
No, I agree. I agree totally. And that's, I once had I was at a reading where that writer, Stuart Dybeck, I don't know if you know him, but he was talking, he was touring, I think it was for his first novel, and he's a really well-known story writer. And they were asking him, well, you know, what's the difference for you? And he was like, well, the difference for me is like when I'm writing a short story, I can always like, you know, reach my hand to the left and feel the beginning and reach my hand to the right and feel the end. He said, you get into a novel and you reach both ways and you don't feel anything. You're just totally lost, you know, you're just adrift. And he's just said, I'd never worked in that space before. And so that was really hard. And I think that's true. You know, you get in that sort of those middle pages and you're so far away that the momentum of the beginning is kind of gone and the satisfaction of the end is not there yet. So how do you make, and that's one of the challenges, how do you make it interesting when people are just sort of like walking places and opening a door and eating a meal, you know, all the things that they need to do in order for these sort of plot moments to happen. How do you make them interesting when they do that? And that's part of the challenge, I think, just sort of grinding through all the things that the characters need to do in order for you to have your payoff.
Are there strategies that you have relied on or used to get through those difficult, like middle parts of the book and really what can be often years of trying to figure out what is that character's journey through the middle 200-400 pages of a book?
Yeah, well, the only thing that's really helped me, and I didn't even realize I was doing this until I was about halfway through with my first novel, and I'm trying very hard to do it on this one, was to look at each chapter as a story, right? And so try to have, and I think that's why, you know, again, as an aside, when people sort of complain about MFA workshops and all they really focus on is short stories, but what everyone really wants to write is novels because that's all that sells, right? I think that those tools that you learn writing a story in terms of like tight arcs, you know, and character development, very efficient, all that type of stuff. If you want to abandon that in a novel, go for it. But I think that it absolutely helps you out. So, you know, I sort of, in terms of getting through the middle, I still look at every chapter as its own story. And I treat them that way. Like I have different files for different chapters, right? So I won't look at, you know, when it's time for me to work on this chapter, I'm not looking at everything else. I'm looking at this chapter as its own sort of piece, right? And if it doesn't have some sort of movement in it, right? If it doesn't have some sort of turn that's bringing us forward, then I know it's not going to work. You know, it sounds like a very sort of, I guess, mechanical or almost cynical way to look at it, but I've definitely become of the impression that the only reason a chapter exists is to make the reader want to read the next chapter. That's it. That's like its sole function, right? And so that might seem sort of heartless or something, but that's the way I view it now, right? And so that doesn't mean every chapter needs to end with, and then ... you know, and guess who walked in? You know, it doesn't. That's not what it means. You know, and you can look at lots of books. I would say even books that are plotless. Like one of the examples I like to use is this book, Invisible Cities, by Italo Calvino, which is, it's sort of plotless. It's just like, you know, all these sort of made up cities that are supposed to be like Venice and Kublai Khan and Marco Polo. It's a complicated thing. It's Calvino. But anyway, those chapters to me do the exact same thing in that they're just so excellent that I have to read the next one, right? It's like each city is so brilliant that I've got to read the next one. And so it's the same function. It doesn't have to be necessarily plot that makes you want to move to the next chapter, but there has to be something in each chapter that above all else, it wants the person, makes the person want to read the next one. And so that's sort of how I sort of get through the middle is I try to not think of it as that sort of vast wasteland of a middle and try to think of it in particular sections, you know, this chapter. If I can get this chapter as good as I can, it's going to make them want to read the next one, and so I'm good there. And so let me start that next one, right? And so, you know, that's like I was saying earlier, I very much wanted to do this novel differently because it took me so long for the first one, and I wrote it chronologically, like page 1 through page 300. I really didn't skip around that much, and this time I'm like, well, I'm just going to be all willy-nilly and skip around all the time. And I sort of started that, and now I'm realizing, no, I can't do it because I'm losing that sort of that function of each chapter, right? I'm losing that, you know, I like to think of it in terms of like, how to say it, in terms of like alternating the emotion, the reader's emotion at the end of each chapter. Okay. So I very much like to end one chapter sort of on like a positive note and the next one down, right? Up, down, up, down. I think when you do that, the reader sort of begins to feel sort of a momentum. I would think of it, I've used this before, but I think of it as like a bicycle, you know, the pedal goes up, pedal goes down, pedal goes up, pedal goes down. You do that enough and you're moving, you know? And so that's kind of how I set it up in my head, right? If each chapter can sort of do that, make them want the next chapter, either because they're feeling so hopeful or because they're feeling so low, then we got momentum.
Yeah, one place you see this incredibly clearly is in dramatic television. If you notice where the commercial breaks are, that final scene before the commercial break is designed, you know, in a novel, it's sort of like designed to push you forward because you want to keep reading. But television, it's crystal clear. There's a capitalist reason, which is we want you to watch the commercial so you'll turn in. And if you look at it, there's always something new presented that we want to know the answer to, typically at an act break. And the same is true, not just in television and Shakespeare and theater. One of the things I noticed was most engaging to me about My Sunshine Away are the fathers in the book. They're either incredibly present, almost domineering to a madness, or they're absent in a very painful way. You know, it tells the story of a rape of a 15-year-old girl. The father of the 15-year-old girl subsequently becomes almost obsessive. He's compared to a hawk in the book, overwatching her. And then the narrator who tells the story, who is one of the suspects in the rape, who is the same age as the girl, his father is very absent, and there's almost an incredibly painful scene in which he goes out to fish with his father, and his father brings his young mistress and all of his younger friends with, and it was this day he'd sort of hoped to have alone with his father. You became a father when you were writing this book, and I was just wondering what you were thinking about fatherhood and how maybe your own relationship with your father impacted your writing of that relation, the complex relationships in the book.
Well, yeah, I would think that, I mean, fatherhood is definitely one of the main things I'm thinking about in the novel. And that wasn't, again, like I was saying earlier, me having kids has changed the book, right? Because I didn't start off writing thinking that was what it was going to be about at all, right? But sort of as I'm going through it, as my own life's changing, and as like with anything in the novel, I'm looking for focus, that was definitely one of the places I found it. And so if you've read the novel, you understand sort of who the novel is talking to, right? That becomes a big part of it. And I think that you're right. We sort of see the different spectrums of fatherhood in it. And I think that the narrator for me is trying to find that sweet spot, right? So is aware of that he doesn't want to be like his own father in many aspects. He doesn't want to be like these other fathers. And so where can he find it, you know? And one of the first places, I mean, one of the places he eventually looks is just like through honesty, right? So he's trying to be as open and honest about all of his faults, everything that he went through at those ages, you know, and just trying to establish that sort of open connection.
How much do you think about family in terms of when you're writing? It seems like such a central role in this book. And I was just curious about your own, you know, your childhood and your own family, like, and now, you know, the family you have with your children. How does it impact your writing?
I'm one of these, I'm like a family person, right? I'm one of these people, like everything I don't know. I think that the only thing I've ever really wanted to be great at is like a dad, right? I've just always wanted to be a good dad. My parents split up, you know, when I was young. I don't look back at that as being like, oh, that crushed me. And, you know, I know it did, right? But I'm not bitter about any of these things. I understand adult lives are complicated, you know. But for some reason, that's what I've always just wanted to be, right? And so I feel family is just, I don't know, crucially important. Maybe that's part of the Baton Rouge thing too. I think in Louisiana, family is important to people, you know. I'm always, you know, whenever I run into students and stuff that like don't particularly like their family, you know, I'm perplexed by it because I was just so, I guess, like I said, if you're going to quantify my life, it looks like I should be one of these really bitter people. But perhaps just through the sheer energy and love of my mom and my sisters and my dad, I'm not one of these people. I just believe family's it for me. Again, I know it's not for everybody. When I'm writing, I'm definitely trying to honor family and love and, you know, familial love, you know, and those sort of sense of community. I mean, that's the reason I after moving away from Louisiana, even though those are great years for me, I just wanted to get back. Because to me, there's something, maybe it's because I was raised here and maybe people in Michigan feel the same way about Michigan. I have no idea. But there's something so important about community here that I've felt I was lacking everywhere else I was. Maybe it's because I was an outsider to it. You know, that's very possible. But I don't know. Whenever I'm here, I feel a sort of sense of belonging, not only for me, but I feel like people believe in their families. You know, it's like when I don't know, our kids are at school and like, you know, the dads are dropping them off and we go and do this dad child weekend where we go camp out and all that type of stuff. And it's like all the press is so bad about families and dads, you know, and that's one of the things I have to get on my students about all the time. You know, I think at one point I told a class, I was like, if I read like another abusive father, I'm giving everyone a C. Like, it's just such a cliche at this point. You know, it's like we just search for these sort of ready-made emotional scars. And so, well, who's going to be the person that did it? Well, the dad, of course, you know. And I know that there are terrible dads out there. I realize it. But I think as soon as any writer is just sort of reaching for that, because it's the low-hanging fruit, as they say, you know, let's just have a drunk Southern dad just beating everybody. I look out the window. I look down my street. I look at my neighborhood. I look at my school that the kids are at, and I don't see those. I see a lot more good dads than I do terrible ones. So what's the reality there, you know?
You know, you said interestingly in an interview a few years ago that you feel like sometimes you have to defend Louisiana and the South, and you sometimes are even surprised at your own reaction when people are dismissive of the South. And I was curious about what you feel people misunderstand about the South, and given, you know, the affection you have for your childhood in Baton Rouge, despite the fact that there was a divorce, like, what is it you feel sometimes? Because there's also an amazing moment in the book where someone prepares a whole day meal of crawfish and corn and boiled potatoes, and there's another character who's not from the South who doesn't want to eat it because he thinks the crawfish are bugs, right? Swamp bugs. And it's about more than food, but certainly you have a sense in Louisiana, there's a huge sense in Louisiana that food is pleasure and community. The fact that, you know, this other person just can't understand that. You can't even eat the crawfish. And so it's a really poignant moment, but I am really curious about this. Because I imagine there is a lot of dismissiveness when you are from the site. And it's simultaneously, it's strange because I feel like there's also a lot of pressure on Southern writers to live up to this very high level of literary tradition. So maybe start there. Like, what is it when that happens for you, what do you feel like people are dismissive of? What do you feel like you want to be able to communicate?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, I think that what I was so surprised, and I never lived out of the South. I mean, but I'll tell you, I lived in East Tennessee, and I thought that I was up north. There were mountains. It got cold. It snowed, and everyone I met there was like, "Well, you know, it's tough, you know, being from the South and this." I'm like, "What are you talking about? Like, look around. You know, this is not the South." But they identify with that same thing. I was like, "Well, I had to get in my car and drive 700 miles straight south to go home." You know, so I feel like I'm up north. But I was always surprised that it seemed like all people did, or no, I guess let me say it this way: I was surprised that people didn't see through the sort of stereotypes in movies and things like that, like I did, right? So, like, if I'd watch a movie and there's some, you know, hey, Hong Sha, you know, da da da, come on down to the bayou, you know, when I see that, I recognize it as a total joke, right? But when I moved away, I realized, oh no, people think that everyone is like this, right? And not only that, but in people, when they read the papers, like, all they see is the numbers, which I understand. What else are they supposed to see? But, you know, they'll see the rankings, education rankings, and it's Louisiana, Mississippi, you know, that's our big fight, you know, who's going to be 50th, you know? You know, we make a joke of it. Obviously, it's a horrible situation. But I think that they look at just, like, the data, and the data paints a terrible picture. But I don't know very many people, and again, I don't know everyone, obviously, but I don't ever mean people that live down here who really want to live anywhere else, right? So the experience is very much different than the reporting, right? And so when I, you know, when I look, okay, as an example, you know, if you read the paper about like a hurricane and you see pictures of people wading in, you know, waist high, dirty water, and, you know, people, you know, on top of a roof, you know, Katrina is obviously the most horrific example, but we have hurricanes all the time, and there's this type of destruction all the time. And I think when people see that, they think, why in the world would anyone live there? You know, like, why? I mean, just move, by God, you know? Whenever I think of hurricanes, I mean, obviously those things are terrible, but I think of like the people who get in their own boats and hop out from their own driveway and go rescue people and help them, you know? And it's, you know, like we had the Cajun Navy. I don't know if you heard of that, but you know, it's in like my stepdad did that. Like, when my boat was at his house for this when those Baton Rouge floods happened. And I'm calling them to try to figure out if everyone's okay. And my mom's like, yeah, well, Wally's out in your boat. He's rescuing people down a couple neighborhoods over. And it's just that sort of just very natural, not at all put upon desire to help people. And even if you never met them before, it doesn't matter. You help them, you bring them over. It's that sort of hospitality thing that's down here that I think is more than just a commercial for New Orleans. It's real, you know? And that's the type of thing that I admire, and I want to respect, and I want to, you know, if I'm writing about Louisiana, I definitely want that as part of it, not because, like I said, it's not a postcard by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a sort of fundamental aspect of the people here.
That was really an interesting aspect of My Sunshine Away, because as I was reading it, I was thinking, okay, I wasn't really thinking this is a Southern novel, but I was definitely thinking about Baton Rouge, and because I've never been to Baton Rouge, and I was like, what is this like? And what struck me more than anything is the universality of some of these situations, characters with unrequited crushes in high school, the strict hierarchy of the way high school can lay down between jocks and the pretty girls and the less pretty girls. Interesting you mentioned the Challenger, because there's a scene in the book where one of the young narrator is watching the Challenger explode in 1986. And it's strange, you know, I'm a few years younger than, but I had the exact same experience in Los Angeles growing up. I was in a room, the cart was wheeled in, we were all going to watch it take off, and 90 seconds in, the shuttle exploded, right? And so it's strange, because there's almost like a claustrophobia in the book a little bit about the strict structures with which high school goes down. And it's not like my high school experience growing up in Los Angeles was so different from that. And that's what was interesting to me, is I think sometimes people go to Southern books, or quote-unquote Southern books, Southern writers, and they expect this specific slice of life and bayous and swamps and, you know, that they think is going to be something unique that's going to remind them of Faulkner, right? And I didn't feel that way reading My Sunshine Away. I didn't feel that at all. And do you think people who grow up in the South, who write books set in the South, feel a certain pressure around their representation of people in the South and the identity they come from?
Yeah, I do. I don't know. It's tough, because you'll find some writers that, like, all they want to do is just sort of break out of that, right? And they don't call me a Southern writer, right? But then once they, I think, once they like publish a book and they recognize how Southern bookstores and Southern readers embrace them, that changes, you know, because the truth of the matter is some of the greatest bookstores in the country are in the South, and some of the greatest readerships are in the South, and they're very just sort of loyal to Southern writers, right? So there, I think there is a part of it that's really nice to have, to feel like you sort of have a family when you write, sort of automatically, you know, and just, you know, I just know from conferences and festivals and stuff that it is a sort of family. You know, you meet someone else and you realize they're writing in Mississippi or you're writing in Georgia, and it's like we automatically have something in common, you know, which we may be totally different people, but it feels that way. In terms of certain pressure, I think there's definitely a group of young writers coming up right now that feel like they want to represent where they come from in a way that's not yet been done, right? I think of David Joy and these writers that are writing about Appalachia, and he's very, very conscious of where he comes from and what he's saying about where he's from, right? Which I think is different than, well, what I said earlier, just make it easier on yourself. I'm just going to set it here because I grew up here. That's different than saying, I need to write about this place for this particular reason, right? Because people don't know it. Right. I think that's better. Right. If you have a sort of reason for setting something somewhere and telling it. I don't know if people still feel like they have to write like Faulkner. I think that if you were to read a lot of the Southern novels coming out now, you could definitely still see that influence in the language. And Cormac McCarthy, I think, is just a huge influence. I mean, we have a lot of I think a lot of Southern writers that lyricism is crucial to them. Right, I mean the song of it is just crucial. I don't particularly feel that way in terms of my prose style, but it's definitely, I don't know, you could see it everywhere. William Gay, I think, casts a long shadow. William Faulkner casts a long shadow. Cormac still working casts a long shadow, and you see a lot of these novels doing that. So do they feel pressured that they need to write that way because where they're from? I don't know. Or do they just love that type of language? And maybe the reason they love it is partly from because where they're from. I'm not sure. But I think trying to live up to Faulkner is a doomed enterprise.
If you hadn't been a writer, what do you think you would have done with your life? What would have been given you the greatest joy outside of writing?
Okay, well, those are two different things. What would I have done with my life is I would have been a lawyer. Right. My dad was an attorney. He never pressured me. He was actually really great. And it's like, you know, you do whatever is going to make you happy, because he's like, I'm an attorney and I'm miserable. However, you know, it's a good living, you know, and you could make a living doing this. And I was dating a girl in college who came from a wealthy family. And when her mom found out that I wanted to be a writer, you know, I was an English major, I was going to go to graduate school and be a writer and professor and all this type of stuff, I started suddenly getting letters from like Tulane Law School and LSU Law School and all these area law schools, because her mom had gone on and signed me onto their mailing list so that I would, if I was going to marry her daughter, which I did not, I was going to be an attorney.
Really subtle,
yeah. I was just getting all this mail. So that's part one. What would I have done? I bet that's what I would have done if it wasn't for writing. What would have given me the most joy? I don't know. I mean, I like cooking a lot, you know. I like things like that. So I think playing music, I'm not good at these things, but I enjoy them, right?
Yeah, let's assume you would have been really good at them. What would have been? Because I think about this a lot, weirdly. Like, I love music, and I'm like, oh, I would have been, if I could be a musician, I would have been a musician.
Yeah, I don't know, drummer or something. I don't know. But, you know, those aren't things that you have to, like, totally abandon. You know, I still like to fiddle with music. I still like to cook, and I still like to do all those things. But what would have given me the most joy? I don't know. Something, again, I think it has to be something that, like, I feel challenged by, you know. And so any of those things would probably work.
When you think about your perceived weaknesses or disadvantages or all the things that we think, do you think that, you know, in the long run, some of them have actually turned out to be helpful for you? Meaning, like, whether it's focus, whether it's stubbornness, is there anything you think of when you think about yourself that's something you used to think, you know, this is a weakness, and now you think maybe this is a strength?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have, like what we started talking about with the sort of obsessive revision. I think it's a strength if people think that the book's any good, right? Because the only reason the book's any good is because I went over it 400,000 times. You know, I mean, it definitely did not exist in that way when it first came out, you know, when it first went on the first draft, and in the same way now. So, you know, whenever I was talking about the book and when it came out, and people would say, gosh, 7 years, you know, I can't believe that, you know, I mean, your next one's not going to take that long, is it? Well, I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know, because the only thing I know for sure is that the only way I could get the paragraphs the way I wanted them was to spend that much time. Maybe I'm just slow, you know, and I think that there comes a point in time where you sort of realize, okay, well, this is just who I am. You know, those first few years writing, you know, you're all over the place. At this point, although I still have a ton to learn, I recognize that. I also know that if I speed through something, it's just not good. You know, it's just not nearly as good as it could be if I'm thoughtful about it. And I turn it over a million times, and I'm thinking about it when I'm laying down, going to sleep, you know, and I'm thinking about it. I just know that's true. So I think that the sort of revision and the sort of slow pace, I hope is a strength.
How do you know you're done? Because I was thinking about when you work on something for 7 years and you go over it, you know, thousands of times. And I believe I was actually reading that you had an interview with Tom Franklin, I think one of your old professors at Ole Miss, the MFA program there, talking about how, is it ever really done? Because there's this question that creeps into perfectionism, you know, and you read stories of the short story writer Raymond Carver at readings, crossing out words and changing them, right? Was there a moment when you finished My Sunshine Away where you're like, okay, it's done, it's ready? Or do you just feel like this is a point where this is, I can put this out in the world and be proud of it?
Yeah. No, I felt that it was done. It was the type of thing where once I realized, I knew what, like, my last line was going to be. I knew, you know, this is several years into it, and I sort of knew what the sort of focus was, what the narrator's reason for telling is. I knew what the last line was. I knew how the plot was going to resolve. Once that happened, I was just sort of running to the end. I mean, that was a great feeling. You know, that was, you know, maybe the last 40 pages of the book or something, where I just felt like, okay, I know what I'm heading towards. And that was a lot easier to write. And, you know, and I felt like I was really moving towards it. And I knew what my last line was going to be. And so when I put it down, it was done. I'm not, you know, Tom was very interesting in what he was talking about in that interview when he said, you know, actually feels like his stories are done. He feels like his novels, he would go back and change all sorts of things. He's a lot wiser and been around and done a lot more than I have. So I don't know what's going to happen to me. Whenever I do look back at My Sunshine Away, I don't see anything I want to change. It's not because I think it's perfect, but it's because it's the best that I could do. When I sent that book to my agent and all that type of stuff, I didn't want to change anything. Again, that's part of that combing over process. I was not, when I sent it, it was done. And I knew it. Right. Because I'd gone over everything. There wasn't a chapter that hadn't been gone over like hundreds, if not a thousand times.
What's your favorite part of being a writer?
Favorite part is if I go back and look at something that I wrote like months or years ago, and it still makes me like smile or crack up, you know, that's my favorite part. That sort of feeling of delight, you know, surprise in yourself. You know, sometimes you go back and you read something and you're like, oh, yeah, I forgot that line. You know, that's a pretty good line. I like those moments, right? It's like just like little small victories that are like buried, you know, throughout the pages. That's my favorite part of the process. And then there's also the just incredible feeling of like when someone's actually read your work and has said it meant something to them. That was totally foreign to me up until a couple of years ago. And I still, like, even when just someone says, oh, I've read your book and they talk about a specific part, I get goosebumps, man. You know, it's just really strange that someone took the time out of their life to sit there and read it and is coming back at you with something other than venom, you know? they seem somehow appreciative of all the effort you put, you know? That feels great. But of course, you know, the problem is in order to get there, you have to actually write the thing. Yeah.
That leads me to my next question, which is, what's your least favorite part of being a writer?
Well, yeah, I mean, my least favorite part is the new material. And I know that sounds terrible because that should be my favorite part. But my least favorite part is blank page stuff. And it's not writer's block. It's like, it's just looking at it and just feeling sort of
I don't know, just anxiety and fear about what it's going to be and is it going to be any good and all that type of stuff. I know I should just get over it. But that's at this point in my life, that's my least favorite part, is that blank page, is that sort of forming new stuff. Yeah, other than that, I mean, it's great, man. I've gotten to meet so many other writers that I admire, and you know, it's a great community of writers out there. There's, you know, people talk about people not reading. That's total bullshit. There's so many people that read, you know, and you come across all these people that are reading not only your novel but other people's, and I love that. I love that community, you know, and that's part of, you know, reason why I still like teaching, you know, and like being around, because I'm around readers and writers all the time, and I recognize that might be a strange, it might be strange to other people, you know, like all of my friends from high school and friends outside of the writing world, they're not constantly surrounded by people that think this is really important, you know, and like words are important. And so teaching allows me to sort of surround myself, with that, you know, which I think is good, and it's inspiring, and it helps me. It definitely like gives me new books to read, and it definitely makes me feel like, I need to do good work in order for me to be able to sit here and tell other people how to do good work. You know, it's sort of that, I feel like I got to back it up, you know? And so that teaching inspires me in that way, to make sure I'm good at the page. If I'm going to be sitting here yapping to these other people, about being good on the page.
And Mom, a final question, an unfair question. If you had one final meal out here in New Orleans, where would you go have it?
Is it lunch or dinner?
We're going to call it dinner, because final last supper.
Jeez, man. That is really hard. If we wanted to go, you know, old school, probably like Antoine's or something, you know? Just old school, do the just fancy, rich sauces, you know? Get some, oh, geez, man. Oysters, we had the escargot, we had... usually some sort of fish, you know, you're going to get like a redfish or something. I don't know. That's really hard. There's too many good ones. You know, if it was lunch, I would have a roast beef po' boy from Liuza's. You know, so that's the thing. It's like, everybody's like, well, where's the place to eat in New Orleans? I'm like, well, what's your mood today? You know, like, I got 1,000, you know.
I'm always like, how much time do you have? I'm here for a week, and I just keep feeling like I have to leave on Saturday, and all I keep thinking is, there's like 300 or 400 restaurants I still haven't been to. Yeah, you feel like you could eat here for days.
You can. Well, there's something like 1,600 restaurants in the city. I mean, it's like it's impossible to eat at all of them, you know. But I think you definitely, you know, I don't know. Oh, and it's crawfish season now too. You go to a crawfish boil. That's good stuff. I don't know, man. Actually, Commander's Palace. Have you? Oh yeah, Commander's Palace would be a good one. 25-cent martinis at lunch. Yeah, that helps.
Emo, thank you so much for being on Notes in Your Notes. I wish you the best on your next novel, and I hope it takes however long it has to take.
Well, thank you so much. This was fun. Thanks.
A huge thanks to Emo Walsh for being on the show. You can purchase My Sunshine Away at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and hopefully even your local bookstore. You can find him on Facebook and Twitter as well. Josh will be back next week. The editing and sound design is done by yours truly. If you want to send us an email, that's notesonyournotes@gmail.com, and we'll talk to you next week.